So I want to thank everyone for coming out on this chilly evening. Supposed to get into the teens tonight. And this enormous avalanche of snow that has befallen us, some 2.5 inches, which shuts down the city for 2 days. But I really appreciate people turning out in spite of the difficulty. And next week will be a discussion on this particular topic. And this topic tonight is feelings unleashing thoughts. So we're building on feelings. We have looked upon the three feelings, tones, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And now we're seeing how they move the mind, how the feelings don't just settle as feelings, but they become something in themselves. And that becoming something in themselves creates the sense of self within their becoming. So we'll talk about that tonight. But I want to pull back just a little bit and just give a full embrace to what we're doing, a full embodiment of the practice. We started, of course, with the physicality of our body as a foundation of mindfulness. But a full embodiment of the body isn't just connecting with it. It's really knowing what's going on within it. I think in the most superficial understanding of the first foundation is just, you know, having some mindful relationship with the body. But the exploration, the full investigation of what the body is, as well as what the mind does within the body, so that there's a complete understanding after these foundations are explored as to what this thing is and how it is in any particular moment and what it's holding in terms of its conscious and unconscious tendencies. And so there's no surprises in this thing anymore. And so what we're really doing is really embracing this mind and body with an intentional introspection, so that everything is known to us, everything is seen, everything is revealed to be what it is. And when we start looking at feelings, we need to understand what those are and how they line up and create and have some compelling force forward in our lives. And so all of this is beginning to make sense in terms of the foundations as to how this thing comes into being as a complete representation of myself with my history and my future and my present disposition. Now, so that's an important, I think that's important to understand what we're doing here. We're not just trying to be present with the body as some physical sensation and then know when a feeling is occurring and then know when a state of mind is arising, etc. But really to see how they play upon each other to form the illusory sense of someone being in here and the world being outside of it. So as we build upon these block-by-block foundations, it's good to keep that in mind. But I want to take us back for a moment in terms of to tie this into the present talk this evening. There was a study that was highlighted in the New York Times, I think, last week. And I'd just like to engage us in that study, if we could. I think it was a Harvard study. And so I would like to ask you to just close your eyes, and I'd like you to deliberately daydream. Close your eyes and let your mind wander without trying to be mindfully present. Just see where it goes. Okay, so you can open your eyes. Some of you probably couldn't get out of the present to allow yourself to escape, but that's to your credit. However, what this study did was it randomly selected cell phones, I guess in some 100, 200, 500 people, and it would call them at odd times during the day, and it would, when the phone rang, the person was to tell them where their mind was at the point when their mind, when the bell rang, when their phone rang, not when they answered the phone. And that way they did a sort of a study of where minds were when the phone rang. And so here was the result. Some 47% of the time when the phone rang, the minds had wandered to another location. They weren't present at the location where the phone rang. All right, so, and the person that was doing the study says, I find it kind of weird to look down a crowded street and realize that half the people aren't really there. But I would actually say that probably upwards to 99% of the people weren't really there, even though they may have been thinking about what they were doing at that moment in that location. That doesn't mean that they were present to that moment, that the thought was just not sending them to another location. But most of the time we spend kind of mulling over what's going on in our life here, trying to figure out and logistically how to deal with the problems, but still our mind isn't really present because it's being interceded by a thought buffers ourselves from that present. And the person said, wherever your mind went, this study shows that daydreaming would not make you as happy as being present. Some scale of happiness. I guess the people who they called up and were actually present at that moment, their scale of happiness was higher than those whose minds were wandering to a different location. He said, even if you're doing something that's really enjoyable, that doesn't seem to protect against negative thoughts. The rate of mind wandering is lower for more enjoyable activities, but when people do wander, they are just as likely to wander towards negative thoughts. And whatever people are doing, whether it is having sex or reading or shopping, they tend to be happier if they focus on the activity they're doing instead of thinking about something else. So I always like these very tangential references and validations of Buddha Dharma. And this is one. Because let's just take apart just a little bit of, no matter what, even if you're doing something that's really enjoyable, that doesn't seem to protect against negative thoughts. And the rate of mind wandering is lower for more enjoyable activities, but when people do wander, they are just as likely to wander towards negative thoughts. So just because you're doing something enjoyable doesn't mean that you aren't miserable, basically. That your thoughts, if you let them wander, won't take you to a miserable location or an attitude or a cantankerous disposition or whatever. And that there's also, that if you focus in on the activity you're doing, whether it be an enjoyable activity or not, but just focusing on the activity that you're doing, instead of thinking about something else, you're ultimately more likely to be happy and focusing on that. So limiting, when you limit it, the range of the wandering thoughts, in other words. So I think this is very interesting, and I think it has a lot to do with what I was talking, and what I'm going to talk about tonight, which is feelings unleashing thoughts. But we get a sense that even science now is verifying sort of the groundwork of what we're going to be saying. And the groundwork starts out with a word in Pali that many of us know. It's a quite familiar word to some of us, and that's papancha. Papancha sounds like what it is. It's the elaboration of thinking. It's papanchan, right? Your mind just is proliferating outwards and obsessively. You can't reel it in. The root of papancha means spreading out. It's the unbidding going of the mind. I like that. It's not that we wanting it to go out that way. It's just going out that way. It's like the spreading of oil on water. It just moves, and it's boundaryless. It doesn't have, it doesn't stop. It just keeps spreading. And one commentator spoke about it like this, and notice that as he's speaking about it, he's papanchizing. One commentator on papancha defines it this way: the propensity of the worldling's imagination to erupt in an effusive of mental commentary that obscures the bare data of cognition. I don't know where that guy was, but and I always like to. I always look at when you areas of papancha that are quite revealing. Here's one. The New York Times comments that the Lord's Prayer contains 56 words. The Gettysburg Address contains 226 words. The Ten Commandments, 227 words. And the U.S. Agricultural Directive on Pricing Cabbage weighs in at 15,629 words. So, papancha is well. So, but it's not just the U.S. government that has endless commentary about life. It's us. We do. And it's important to begin to realize the value and limitation of this endless spreading out of language from a base camp of feeling. And what's it doing? How does this work? How does it get going like that? What compels it and propels it onward? Why does it seem to be so difficult to have any objectivity to it? Right? And most of us, all of us, have had the experience of just getting lost in this meaningless, trivial nonsense. But you can't seem to get any objective stance to it. It just seems to have its own life within. And one thing I can say is that as people begin to practice, I would say that that we spend less and less of our mental frame of reference in time. I would say that that was true from almost the beginning. When you begin to sit down and just see what the mind does endlessly in its chatter, and that losing ourselves in some kind of daydream or imagination, which we often foster before we realize what we're doing to ourselves, we just bring it on because it's so much more pleasant than just sitting there idly waiting for a bus. Why not just lose ourselves in thinking rather than actually having to sit there and do nothing while you wait? And much of the reading that we do in terms of fantasy, in other words, kind of compels us into a state that drives its own imaginative response to that reading. And on it goes. And I think as we begin to meditate, that there does become a limitation of that endless proliferation. And I can remember that suddenly fantasies just weren't fun anymore. It just wasn't fun. And this doesn't take very long in practice to begin to realize that, you know, just letting your mind wander endlessly just didn't have the same point and purpose that it did prior to my understanding what it was doing. And then very slowly, as practice develops, the ventures out into time become of shorter duration. Oh yes, we still worry about the future and we still regret about the past, but we don't spend as much time doing that. And we don't necessarily lose ourselves in the fantasies and the histories of our early childhood and just trying to recollect everything. It just doesn't make any sense anymore to spend that kind of time doing that. I was walking with Joseph this summer, and I was telling him, I said, I just don't have the same memory that I used to. And he says, I don't either. I said, but I think that that's actually wisdom. I think that I just don't see the point in trying to remember things. And he said, he agreed. He says, what is the point? And I think so that as the practice develops, I think that you just start limiting the slavery to time. And I think that's an important demarcation to note in ourselves, that it just isn't as valuable to spend time just aloft in a way. So let's look at how this works, this proliferation. We need to get in on the investigation of this. Now, remember that we're trying to embody this practice. And to embody this practice is not just to have an intellectual understanding of papancha, but to really experience papancha. It's the difference, I think, is the difference between engaging in a teaching rather than following a teaching. If you sit there passively and listen to a teaching, you'll follow it. You'll follow it intellectually. You may even reflect upon parts of it, and it will have a minor effect upon you. But a full engagement of the teaching requires some interest within the activity of where the teaching is pointing. And much of that, the Buddha said there are many ways to have insight. One of that is by listening. You can listen and have insights as you listen. It depends on how you listen. You listen introspectively so that you let the words take you to your experience of where the words are pointing. And you can actually have insights, not just an intellectual grasping, but an actual integration, an engaged activity with the teaching. And so this ultimately is where we are trying to go in our teaching here at SIMS, is to have an engaged relationship to the teaching so that we're moving with it and seeing and flushing out the areas of our lives and where the teaching is pointing. So this teaching of papancha, or proliferation of thoughts being unleashed by feelings, starts, of course, on contact. Now, any sense door doesn't require a particular sense door for this proliferation to occur. In fact, I don't know if any of you have ever read The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, James Thurber short story. Some of you are probably much too young to even know about it, but James Thurber had this man, Walter Mitty, who, in this short story, would completely lose reference to where he was because of a certain sound he would hear that would take him into a fantasy world. And so one of them was something like, he had a tick, tick, tick of the motor, or something was ticking in his car, and that took him to the beating of an engine in an airplane, and the airplane was on fire and he was going down, and everybody was saying, well, the captain will save us, and he was the captain. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this shout comes, "You're driving too slowly, dear. What's the matter with you?" Which is his wife next to him in the car, who wakes him up out of the fantasy. But that tendency for us just to skip the touch and on contact. The contact. Why is the what's wrong with the contact? Contact? Feeling. Feeling. The moment you're in the car, there's an expression or a feeling that may not be pleasant. Having perhaps a disagreeable wife next to you, so all of a sudden your mind just skips. It can't stay in the car. It's with that unpleasantness. So it finds its own route towards the pleasant, which for Walter Mitty, of course, was a complete disassociation from being in the car at all. And so contact, feeling, and then there's perception. Perception. Now, perception contains two different qualities. It contains recognition and it contains memory. When there's contact, then there's feeling on base of that contact, and then there can be a recognition, and that can create even more of a sense of feeling from the sense of recognition and the memory of what has been. You can have a feeling about something prior, before you recognize what it is. And then when you recognize, like an example is, I don't know how many of you have been out to Magnuson Park, but they have these shark, the sculptures of these whales, or I guess they're supposed to be orcas, right? Fins of whales. So I didn't know what they were. I had a feeling about them. I mean, my own taste, I didn't particularly like them. I thought I didn't know what they were. Turns out they're wings of an airplane that are stuck up in the soil. Anyway, so then somebody explained what that sculpture was, and so I had a recognition and perception, and then I had a different feeling. I said, oh, the guy's trying to, a pod of orcas. And so then I started thinking about, what it took to bring an airplane wing, dig it into the soil to make it look like a fin of an orcas. And so then my poncha started by thinking of all the man hours, people hours that took and the money to create something that really wasn't that special, in my opinion, at all. So, but anyway, the whole thing was much more, an analogy that comes to mind is like being on a diving board. You walk up the steps, you touch the board, contact. The contact sends, immediately upon contact, is a feeling. A pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Now, it has to be one of those three. It's like yes, no, and maybe. You know, it's there's no other, you can't answer anything but yes, no, and maybe. Pleasant, unpleasant, or feeling. So it's got to be one of those feeling tones that you meet. And then perception and recognition, and then you're at the edge of the board, and you're sprung down on the board, and the flight into the fantasy. Now you no longer have your feet on the surface any longer, and you're just lost in the air of thinking. But it's wonderful up there because it feels as if you're flying, that you can go anywhere. It's boundaryless. It doesn't have any, there are no areas in which you can't go, in which the thought can't travel. In that sense, it's gives an incredible sense of power when you can, if you can lose yourself in the thought and actually believe the thought is real, then it gives you more of a sense of power. The problem is, though, when you become, when you have some sense of meditation within you, some sense of groundedness, you know that you're doing it. And that, of course, disrupts the whole flight from being an imaginative, open experience to one that's very closed and limited. And so, again, it starts reeling us in a little bit. But there is that moment of time for many people who don't have any ground where they are off. They're the Walter Mitties of the world. And they can float and fly freely, of course, until they land on Earth, which is where reality is in opposition to the way they're thinking. When the wife, the disagreeable wife, wakes you up out of your dive, suddenly you're in crash tone and you can no longer escape. And the delight you had in the escape is directly proportional to the distaste you have in coming back to the reality. And so you really face the fact of the disagreeable in that moment. Now, I just want to give a sense of how emotions play into this. Perceptions lead to emotions. Now, as we begin to perceive something, There is a history we've had with what we are perceiving. And sometimes it is an exact history, meaning we've met that person before. Sometimes the person is an inexact replica, meaning they remind us of somebody who we've met before. In any case, the same feeling comes forward. And we place it upon that person, place or thing. Because our mind has a tremendous ability to generalize from its past to the specific of what it's looking at or perceiving or in contact with. But in a feeling, because it has to be no, yes, or maybe, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, will object to or disengage from the experience, quite likely based upon nothing else but a historical representation of that object. But we're lost. We don't care about them anymore. You remind me of my mother. Fine, but I'm not. Doesn't matter, you see, because the feeling has placed itself representatively right there. And then the emotion starts arising from that particular contact. Doesn't matter whether it's your mother or a representation. The emotional history, the feeling tone, and the recognition opens a gate, a floodgate, in which the emotions start coming forth. And because we're not clear in ourselves about, we misrepresent the person as being the mother or the father of the past, we just let that, it's uncensored emotion. It just comes out with all of the negation and all of the difficulty and reactivity that we had with the original person. And we then just steamroll, our emotion just gets steamed up. Now as our emotion comes into view, we have another feeling from that experience. And if it's an unpleasant experience, then the feeling, of course, is unpleasantness, which reignites a whole reactivity. So now the perception had a feeling, the recognition in history had the feeling, now the emotion arises, it has another feeling or a same intense feeling, and the whole thing now adds momentum. It's like a snowball rolling down a hill. It gains momentum on its own. And we get lost. Then we can start having images or flashbacks of our mother or whoever it might be. And we have forced our story into a conclusion. Our story then gets compelled into that. That's where the thinking takes over into papancha. Gets brought, even though part of the story realizes that this person in front of you isn't your mother, still the emotion has such momentum, it can't stop the same conclusion from arising. Even though the person we realize is not our mother, emotionally we do not realize it. Emotionally we have such a lack of intelligence with our emotional life that it's the thing that we have invested in and continues to hold our consciousness within it. Now, I just want to take a little sidestep here and talk about our emotional intelligence, because this is extremely important and often evaded. Many of us evade this point, because we're uncomfortable with this level of psychic memory. But within each of our bodies, within each of our psyches, is an emotional history. And that emotional history arises given the proper context and situations when they're arising externally. It releases some of our emotional history. We're very good in this spiritual culture in noticing judgment, noticing that we're upset, noticing that we're irritated, noticing that we're reactive. We're very poor at being able to investigate sufficiently the cause of that reactivity. That cause of that reactivity is embedded within the moment's expression of the reaction. You don't have to look somewhere else. You don't have to do a biological assessment of yourself to find out where this reactivity comes from. In the moment that that reaction occurs, if we listen carefully to ourselves, you'll hear the emotional residue, the emotional intelligence that holds that particular depiction of events. For instance, if we are with our mother, we might get a feeling inside of some sense of being controlled or of maybe being not listened to, negated in some way, or just completely forgotten, abandoned or some way, I don't know, depends on the history of the mother. And then and then we'll react and we'll have a hard time being with our mother on Thanksgiving or wherever it is. But if we're quiet in that moment, if we're just willing to be quiet, you'll feel the emotional residue of what we are saying to ourselves through the emotion, through the feeling and the reaction to the feeling, creating more emotion and the truth of that. And we just keep, because we let it just move on its own without any awareness of it, it holds a kind of circular truth that just keeps revolving back around. And now the emotional body, the emotional intelligence, sometimes is an emotion itself. Often there are subtle nuances of words or images that come in through that feeling tone. Oftentimes there's a way that the sense of self is being held, holds itself in relationship to that. Like negation, it's feeling incredible despondency or despair or not being seen. And you can feel all of that, but it's that degree of subtlety that has to arise consciously with those emotional imprints in order for those imprints to be completely fleshed out. Otherwise, the subtlety consists and maintains itself over time, continuing to brood within a feeling, investing in an emotional response, conjuring up memories, and the whole thing. We can take the steam and the pressure off the pot, but unless we turn down the burner, turn off the burner, that's just a temporary, satisfactory expulsion of energy. I mean, as soon as you put the pot back, the top back on, it starts boiling again. And I think that's why we are often incomplete in our complete resolution of emotional traumas. And I don't mean traumas in terms of abuse. I mean traumas just in terms of the psychological disarray that many of us were in as we grew up. And it needs that kind of subtlety from us. It needs that willingness and intentionality to know this about ourselves. But few people want to go there because it's too unpleasant. It reminds us too much of what our past was. It brings up too many issues for us. We get lost in the issues. We just lose our bearing within those issues. And then when we're lost within that, then we're just completely helpless. And we have no way to find our way back. But if we realize that the feeling tone, if we can feel the feeling tone of what is arising in that moment, it gives us a very nice base to be able to see what's arising on top of that feeling tone, the unpleasantness. If we're willing to hold the unpleasantness as the unpleasant, or the pleasant as the pleasant, either one, both are insidious. And just, okay, you know, I get just the willingness and the intentionality to expand so that you aren't contracting to this feeling, but expanding and being able to hold it. I can do this. So what? This is okay. And on it'll go. Now, just to give you a personal story of some When I was a monk, you know, it's not a lot you do when you're a monk. There's a lot of neutral time. So my mind just starts engaging, could, if I allowed it to just engage upon anything that happened, to make it exciting, put some spice in this life. So I remember one time I was given some kind of root, Thai root. I didn't know what I was eating. I just ate it. Anyway, and then I urinated and it came out red. Now, if I had eaten a beet, I would know that, but it wasn't a beet, it was something else. So I didn't put the two, one and one together, and I thought, oh my God, what? Bladder cancer. When you have a lot of time on your hands, you go right to the result, right? Right to the prognosis even. You don't have to go see a doctor, you already know you're going to die in 6 months. And even then I would go and tell another monk, he'd say, you're crazy. And then I'd say, yeah, you're right. And I'd go back and, you know, a week or two later I'd have another problem. And then he'd come to me and he'd have some problem like that. And I'd say, you're crazy. And he'd say, yeah, you're right. And we kept. But with time on your hands, the mind will just, you see, it's trying to find something besides the neutral, something to stir it up, something to keep it alive. And this is the advantage. This is a very strong advantage of reactivity, of proliferation, is that it stirs things up. It keeps life interesting. It keeps a story being told. It keeps a narrative going. It keeps something that you can fight against. It keeps you, God, this is awful, you know? This is awful, believe me, is better than this is uninteresting. And so I want us to each look at our lives and see where we keep it awful so that we won't be uninterested. Because it's in there. And as we begin to go from contact to feeling to perception to thinking to papancha, we are sculpturing ourselves out of clay. I can't think of any other way to frame this thing. But it comes, we arise from an unobserved feeling. Now, a feeling isn't complete, is it? It's not a resolution. It's a feeling. Pleasantness isn't a resolution. It's not complete, is it? It's just a feeling. And so now you begin to see why the sense of self, as it arises within these feeling tones, never feels complete, because it's a feeling. There's no end to a feeling. It just kind of wavers, it goes up and down, waxes and wanes, and then changes to another feeling. And there's no sense of ownership to a feeling, because it's just kind of, in fact, it's quite the opposite. We project out our feelings. We don't own them at all. We don't even give them any credence that they're happening to us. We think they're happening within the object or person that happens to hold our feeling. And then we react to the object or person as if they were unpleasant in their intrinsic nature, rather than we gave it to them as a gift through our feeling. And so the sense of self never gets resolved. Feelings are not final or absolute. And so the story is continually modified as the feelings are modified, as we try to find some conclusion. But feelings, as I was saying, they have no boundaries, you see. There's no finality to them. And so they just keep us seeking fulfillment within that foreverness of them. Now, this is crazy making. Also, it's crazy making when you realize that each of us have psychic weak spots within ourselves, areas where, when we're pressed, when conditions are similar, we will go to them, perhaps for instance. You may feel like you've never been properly appreciated in your life, and then you'll have a job, volunteer or otherwise, in which you don't feel like you're being appreciated enough. That feeling will come out, I'm not being appreciated. Someone else who will be doing that same job may feel not that at all. But then the whole sense of being unappreciated starts percolating and being processed, and we start spreading it out in terms of conclusion. He or she is an inappropriate boss. They don't thank me enough. They don't give me enough backslapping goodwill wishes. I'm not being appreciated. I'm out of here. And look at the patterns over time. These things don't resolve themselves. We find ourselves in the same conditioned feeling, tone, pattern, thought, apancha, time and time again, relationship after relationship, job after job after job. Never taking ownership of the reactivity in itself. Never. The psychic weak spots. It doesn't take long for conditions to bring up our psychic weak spots. And then that feeling will immediately emerge, and because it's been has such momentum from the past, along will come a whole story and narrative associated with it, complete with an attitude and a psychic posture to life, convinced once more we are being unappreciated in life. Personal conclusion, right? From what? Looking at the breath. We started looking at the breath. And it turned out to, I can't do this, I hate breathing, everybody's doing it better than I am, I'm terrible at this. Where did that come from? It came from a psychic weak spot. And those psychic weak spots are just waiting, because those contain the self-assumption. So when the self is blown and the conditions are right, the self is going to speak from those weak spots, because that's where he or she believes about him or herself. The mind spreading out. The mind proliferating out. My teacher Ajahn Buddhadasa, someone asked him once, what was the disposition of the world? How did he see the world? He said, the world is lost in thought. The world is lost in thought. And then, of course, the next step are actions. Actions from the rationale of the feelings, acquiring the desire or eliminating the threat, or continuing the theme of our life. All from pretending. All from pretending. It's like this old story about the young boy who says, Mom, pretend you are walking in the jungle and you're surrounded by 100 tigers. What would you do? And the mother thinks about it and says, I don't know what I would do. And the young child says, I would stop pretending. Suddenly the problem is gone, isn't it? Suddenly the problem has disappeared. May I say that problems will disappear. They will disappear. Your life will become spacious, open, non-formed in that sense of antagonist and protagonist. But what will come in there is the disposition of uninteresting, because we have learned to keep our life so jacked up on intense feeling tones created by my subversive thinking and projection that we are reluctant to give up the intensity of that entertaining experience, even though it comes back to bite us again and again. And just fall to a simplicity, to ordinariness. And there's a moment, there's some time that's required to live within the neutral feelings before the neutral feelings are seen to be, take us to a new dimension. They seem to indicate a drab life. And so we'll keep it stirred up. We'll keep the tiger, ourselves surrounded by tigers. Now, look, have we looked at thought in your practice? Have you spent some time with thought? Have you seen what it is? Are you engaged in this practice? Or just following it? And as we understand what thought is, we realize we don't have any control over it. It just comes. And the less we infuse credibility into it, the less it comes. The more it comes when we invest energy into it to sustain our interest in the feeling tone that it's creating, or the opposite is also true. And notice the hypnotic trance, the Walter Mitty hypnotic trance that we induce ourselves into again and again and again. And the circular thinking that we go through, trying to think ourselves out of an emotional response that we're having. If your thoughts are going around and around, which was one form of papancha, just going around and around and around, what the thoughts are trying to do is solve the emotion at its base, at the hub. But instead of acknowledging the emotion at the hub, we just let the thoughts try to solve the emotion. How can a thought, just dharmically consider this, how can a thought solve an emotion? Of course it can't. Those are two different experiences, one festering and feeding the other, like a cat chasing its own tail, often intertwined and dependent upon one another. But you can't solve one with the other. You can't think your way out of an emotion. So to go to the emotion and just be present to the emotion rather than letting it drive itself into some analytical interpretation seems to me dharmically to make far greater sense. And we want to ignore the emotional pain and get to the conceptual understanding and resolution of that pain. So we don't even honor the emotion in the same way that we infuse our interest in the thinking. We think we can think our way out of our emotional problems. That's not engaged dharma. Thoughts do not bring clarity. We have to stay here for clarity to come. And even that very simple study in the New York Times indicated something. It indicated where happiness lies. It indicated the direction of happiness. It indicated the direction of joy. It indicated the direction of fulfillment. Are you spending your time wandering? Well, you're going to wander into unpleasant thoughts as quickly as pleasant ones. But if you stay present within the activity, if you get interested in what is going on here, you won't be bored, it will not be neutral, and you will find the resolution of joy, the fulfillment and completion of life here. This then is what Buddhism is all about. The me falls apart. The me falls apart. Because it's no longer being built up by story, by reaction to feeling, by infusion of thought with emotions, and emotions reacting to thought, and then feelings playing in, and on, and the trying to escape what our own internal processes. Is there aliveness? And this is a question for each of you. Is there aliveness without story? Is there aliveness with story? Or is aliveness to be found without story? Let us decide and determine which life is best lived. Thank you. So if we can just sit for a minute or two. So are you sitting thinking? Or do you know thoughts are arising? Are you being informed by your thought or directed by them? It's a different life. Those are very different lives. You wouldn't recognize one from the other. See, sitting opens us up to something else. It's a directive. It's an application of a different principle of life. Okay, if there are any questions, I'll try to respond. If you have any. Yeah.
So it's a function of the world that also need to use thought. So it seems the Buddha's direction is to be cognizant when we are using thought as opposed to
yes. Yeah. Yes, yes. The question is the Buddha suggesting that we're cognizant when our thoughts are arising within us? Or because we need to use thought. No question about it. And so this just, it was interesting. I was talking to someone during a retreat, and I was saying, we're moving from conscious to unconscious. No, we're moving from unconscious to conscious. Thank you. She said to me, I feel conscious. I feel like I'm a conscious person. I said, well, every thought unobserved is unconsciousness. Now that puts it in a different, doesn't it? You see? Because that's a conditioned reference that we are giving life that it doesn't contain. That's unconsciousness. To make life something that it is not is the hallmark of unconsciousness. So as we begin to understand the need to be conscious, we also see the need for us to be able at times to be able to use our mind so that it informs us about what we need to do and where we need to go and finding our way back home and handling our professions and all the other ways that we thought. But that's very different than what I'm talking about tonight in terms of papancha, where the sense of self is driving its image forward in terms of reaction and then setting itself up to have a reaction, to feel the emotion, to have another reaction to the emotion, to think more about the emotion, to establish its whole context for life based upon what? Based upon a shoving and a pulling and a shoving and a pulling between different feeling tones. Right? That has no bearing, no truth, no bearing, no truth, and no purpose outside of the purpose that it gives us in terms of its own interest, its own excitement. And the value it gives us in thinking of ourselves as being a three-dimensional person with a past, a future, a present, It gives us breadth, width, height, time, four dimensions, instead of the vacuity of awareness, the limitlessness of awareness that fills all spaces, but is not at times abiding.
It seems like that really happens in relationships when you see them changing.
And then say that, more, Dave.
All that starts then, the, what did I, you know, the emotions begin, the thought yeah. begin, and relationships are going to change over time, but as they begin, it comes to.
Yes. In fact, relationships are an extremely good model for learning that fact if you don't become miserable before you learn that fact. Because there are two histories that are in collision and two reactive patterns that seed the other. I mean, if you have abandonment issues and that person has independent issues, it's just going to be, you know. And people find their way into the perfect psychic match for themselves. And instead of using that for to better understand one's own system, conceptual ideas about oneself and how they're, and how to find you, the pieces that you project outward so that you can find a perfect puzzle to, you know, what am I protruding? What's protruding out of me that fills this gulf in this couple, in this partner? You know, what need do I have that is met by that person's demand? And it's very, very difficult to do. It's impossible to do in reactive patterns. Just, if you can pause and really get and come back and where the emotion has been left, so you can come back and engage in dialogue around what just occurred rather than the emotional reaction of what occurred, you can learn a lot. But from the emotional reaction, very little is learned in the midst of it. It's better just to pull away. Establish time where you come out, where the flooding is dissipated, where you're no longer flooded, and then come back and talk about what happened. But if it starts happening again, it's too soon. You need to be very, I feel the need to monitor that sense of flooding in oneself. Right? Yes. Okay, did I use that word, solving an emotion? What I would mean by solving an emotion is going to the very nuance of it and allowing those messages to come into consciousness, the subtlety of it. And it kind of it pulls up the root system that reaction pattern has been based upon. And so understanding completely the subtlety is the complete resolution. It no longer has the charge to it. It can't come back in the same way because it's been seen. And so ultimately making it conscious is what and how we make it seen. But you have to get serious about it. It gets done very quickly when you're serious about it, but it takes decades and decades. Well, it never gets done. It never gets completely done if you're not. You have to be very serious about doing this. And really, really, okay, I want to see this. You have to really want to see it. That's what seriousness means. And I just don't find many people that serious. Because they found ways to sidetrack themselves, to obscure it, to dance around it, to give themselves a little more time, because the hard issues can be, you can skirt them for a long period of time. But when you don't have a lot of time left in your life, then you might decide to get serious. Yes, sir. It's a good question, yes. So how important do I think it is to understand the original source of the path? I think it is helpful to understand where the conditions of the problems arose. I don't think it's important to dwell upon those conditions. But what it does do, when you understand that an insane home brought this insanity to you, it takes the self-blame off of it. So you don't feel so contaminated by your own mind. You know, you see that it was a malignancy that was passed over to you. And so it's very helpful not to have that self-blame. That doesn't really help you deal with the emotion itself as an experience, but it does give you a whole sense of accommodation or allowance once that emotion wants to be seen. So from that point of view, I think it can be helpful. But people dwell upon that because of the blame issue. You know, then they can, once they see it's not their fault, then they can keep it very separate from them and not having to feel that themselves at all, because it's their mother did that to them. So hating the mother becomes the way that we heal to the emotional rift, rather than dealing with it straight on. So I don't think that's very helpful at all. Okay, thank you all. And we have just a few announcements here.